How can you be part of a religious community that straight up denies
sometimes
science
it feels
or
like the church is trying to hold
the church
on
seems to be stuck in their ways when the rest of the
why are they so obsessed
they
with
they keep trying
people.
To give answers
I would
but they
never
don't even
be a part of a church
we're
that
asking
I'm not welcoming
the church is the most vocal political voice
period.
Against immigration.
Some churches still the one thing that worship was the actual
do you understand
how
story ridiculous that is when
the majority of people on
the church seems to be stuck in their ways when the rest of the culture
how is that actually
it seems like so much of the church
exclusive, anti-critical thinking, homophobic, too narrow, judgmental, disconnected from what is truly happening in the real world.
The church needs therapy.
Welcome to the newest episode of The Church Needs Therapy. And today, our very special guest is Britt Barron. And Britt is a speaker, teacher, and author of her new book that came out last year, Worth It. And
yeah.
Britt spent the first part of her life in the evangelical church and eventually became a pastor at a mega church. And according to her website, at the ripe age of 26, where apparently, according to the website, you peaked. So you peaked at 26.
That is, my Christianity for sure peaked. It was all downhill
the last
from there.
9 years. I don't.
Yeah. After that, well, questionable.
And after that moment, she started to understand more about herself, her dreams, and her sexuality. And she met a woman named Sammy that changed, saved, and transformed her whole life. Meeting Sammy, leaving the church, coming out, getting married, that is a whole story and journey right there, have given Britt a deep-seated passion for reminding people that choosing freedom is always worth it, no matter the cost, which I love. Britt and Sammy now live in Austin, Texas, and you still have your dog, Charles Barkley?
Yes, you might hear him snoring a
nice.
Little bit. He's laying right down on my feet, just knocked out.
And Britt is passionate about having honest and at times difficult conversations and also finding joy every single day and making time to have as much fun as possible. Britt, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and the listeners and with me today.
Yes, I'm so excited. Thank you
Let's
for getting up early for this.
Yeah, I know. Well, I haven't set an alarm for years. I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. So if it's 6 a.m., they're
okay.
In here asking for a banana and we're getting the day started. So this is actually, I've already lived a life this morning.
Okay, yeah, wow. Much respect.
Let's start with the most important question I can think of with me following your whole journey. Alicia Keys posted about your book last week. What is that about?
Oh my gosh, I know. Isn't that wild? No, it was so wild. Me and my wife, we were in LA visiting friends because we recently moved to Austin from LA. Mm. And so we went back for the weekend for a friend's birthday. Shout out to Pfizer for making this all possible.
I know, right?
But and we went to get coffee. I looked at my phone. And you know when you see something, you're like, that doesn't feel right.
Yeah,
you know?
It's like weird.
Yeah, you're like, Alicia Keys mentioned you. And I'm like, are you sure it's like Alicia, like,
yeah,
Hayes,
it's Alika
like, from
Keys.
High
there was no, there was
yeah,
no
yeah,
I
exactly.
after the C. It was Alika.
Yeah. like Ray fans. Like, so, then I don't even know. So wild, such a, you know, it's just so like it, putting things out of the world is so wild because in 2016 I did a TED talk and I did it all about race, which in 2016 was like, you know, people were talking about it but like not talking about it like they are today, and it like kind of got some views, and then like 4 years later it like blew up, right? Like in 2020. And then you like put out a book and you're like, okay, like what's, you know, and you kind of like start to like wind down, and then Alicia Keys shares it and you're like,
yeah,
what? What's sick. Happening?
Yeah, it's so cool.
So we're pretty much best friends. I'll probably
go to her
house after this interview.
You immediately DM'd her. You're like, I mean, it's cool. Do you want to like talk about it? You want to like hang, girl?
Yeah.
I mean, she never hit me back, but.
Yeah, girl, text me. I'll come over.
You know, because you just said that about the 2016 TED Talk you did, about race. And then obviously now the last year in people's consciousness, it's like, oh, institutionalized white supremacy. That's a term people know. Systemic racism. That's like the word of 2020. Yes. I'm going to jump. I had a question like this for later, but I want to jump ahead even before a little bit of an intro.
Yeah.
And I could totally be wrong about this. You could be like, I've never thought that, Kev. That's just you. You got issues. But do you ever have moments where if you've been doing work around race, right? Not just like thinking and writing about it, but actually doing work, whether it's organizing about it. Have you ever had moments in 2020 where people are doing this and almost like blowing up off of saying certain things or being the one who knows about this? And deep down, you're like, the work itself is good and you want to celebrate movement and those conversations anywhere. But part of you deep down is like, man, we've been talking about...
You know, there, yeah, you know, okay, yes.
Maybe, you know, hey, maybe not, maybe that's just me at times.
No, and there is like, oh my gosh, I was just talking about this with a friend the other day, because I'm like, listen, like, and not to like toot my own horn, but when you get into this work, like you're in this, like in high school, I was on our school's diversity council. I remember I organized a walkout in protest of like racism happening at our school. Only one person came. It was me and one other person, and all we did was get written up for like ditching class. Like
it was me and one other person. It was my friend, and he didn't even go to the school. He just came.
Look, right, yeah, he was like on his lunch break, and so like you know, and walkouts and sit-ins and petitions, and then all the stuff, and so you know that like over the course of doing this work, it's like foot on the gas. It's also rest. It's also breaks. It's also conversations. It's also coffees and dinners. Mm. It's like organizing. And so something that I haven't thought of a lot is like, I'm seeing these people, but I'm like, bro, this pace is not sustainable. Mm. Like what you're going at right now. Mm. It's not sustainable. Like you're going to like burn all the way out. Mm. Like, and so how do, like, and social media is such a weird part of that, but I am seeing these people where I'm like, ooh, child, like, I'm here for you when you need a break, a rest.
Yeah, yeah.
Sabbatical.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there for me, even when I hear you saying that, because one, to me, a part of that speaks to, like, I've always thought, and I've never been an insider, like not growing up in the church, but I've also been aware of like sort of the Christian industrial complex, that evangelical like machine where I'm like, that culture has the ability to co-opt anything.
Yep.
And brand it really well and like, you know, do work around it. And then, you know, you can co-opt it without the depth of the long marathon of the substance of working for it. And then it's like branding and obviously it's media, people have a following. But for me, sometimes I ask that question, I jumped ahead because you said that, and I laugh because, let's see, I'm 36, so like 12-ish years ago, I was at Fuller. And when I was there, I was studying Black and womanist theology, and that was like the focus of my work. And I remember now people saying stuff, I'm like, if I brought up the system of mass incarceration or the prison industrial complex or liberation theology when I was at like a white megachurch, Orange County, 12 years ago, nobody wanted to hear a damn thing about it. People were like, you know, not interested or unaware. I mean, I've had some uncomfortable things happen as a result. I'm like, now 12 years later, that pastor's freaking woke. All right, cool.
Yeah. And you're like, you know, it has tested like some... I don't know if compassion is the right word or like what, but yeah, like when you're that person ringing that bell, that's like, we need to talk about intersectionality. We need to talk about Black trans women. We need to use these words. We need to like, you know, switch up this language or whatever. And people are like, you're radical, like you're too much or whatever. And now those same people are like, we need to talk about intersectionality. We need to talk about, and you're like, It's testing a very specific part of me that I don't know is the best, where I because I've thought about this and I'm like, the old pastors at our church, I'm like, what if one day they were like, hey, we are affirming now. And then everyone like was like, yay, like clap for them. I'm like, what would I feel? Like, I would definitely feel some type of way about that. I'm like, bro, you made my life so hard for years.
Yeah.
And so it's tough because then I also, again, being full circle back, I think about myself and I'm like, well, someone's looking at me and thinking that, you know. Like, someone heard me preach back in the day when I was super evangelical, and now I'm like, yeah, like, let's get, you know, Black trans women the protection they need, and they're looking at me like, you know, where were you for me?
So,
you know, it's both, and I definitely see where I fit into that, and where it rubs me the wrong way, and then I'm like, but is it you, though? You know? Yeah. Have you been there?
Yeah, well, when I think about that for myself, I'm like, as a person who is doing that as an ally, not as a person who has had an entire economic and political system leveraged against them, I'll have those thoughts, you know, as a white dude, where I'm like, man, I was getting killed for this, or I was like being ignored, or just when I was, you know, first kind of doing that work or whatever. And then I think that when I see a white person, I'm like, and also, Kevin, a Black person could look at you and say, wow, you started talking about this 12 years ago. That's awesome. We were talking about this way before that, and we've been experiencing this for 400
years.
Yeah,
yeah, we were living it. Exactly. that's the hardest. I firmly believe this. I think one of the hardest parts of the work is when you acknowledge your own presence in it. You know, we can intellectualize all day and night. We can throw terms around. We can, you know, we can approach this, but when you are able to sit and say, I recognize where I have participated, where I have consumed these ideas. I understand the lives that have been impacted. I acknowledge that right now I'm in the midst of another transformation, I'm sure. Right. So when you can understand that, it should shape your work in a different way.
Absolutely.
Right, like, we should come about it in a different way because you understand.
And also with that, with what you're saying, like, that's the humbling part, or many times humiliating to the ego, when you have the self-awareness to be able to see, because it's even like in relationships, it's like, well, you don't, you know, it's like me and my wife joke around with like little things in the relationships. Mm-hmm. We've been together forever. It's like, my wife never takes hair out of our brushes.
Yeah.
Like, ever.
Yeah,
so. And now my daughter's following suit. She's four now. So two against one now. All I do is clean up hair around the brushes. And because I put like hairspray in my hair, if I like brush it through, it'll like get stuck. And I can't stand that. I just don't like it.
Yeah.
And when that little thing can start to, like, your ego contracts a little, you're like, oh, like, again. And I'm like, you know what though? I'm like, I don't do that. But when I come home and I change, I just throw my clothes somewhere and like don't pick it up. And that's a lot of times the wisdom of like that thing over there. I don't do that exactly, but I have my own versions of where I'm falling short or doing this imperfectly. And I think with what you said, a lot of times the humility and the awareness of that doesn't always just transform the nature of the work, but it transforms us as we're doing the work, to do it with less antagonism, to do it with less of a rub. It's like, yeah, I'm calling it out, but like, I'm also an idiot and I've been doing this, you know what I mean? So
it should change the way, again, we approach the work. And I think that so much of like, I talk about this a lot, like, for those of us who grew up in any way evangelical or part of the church, right, we have this bend, like, we've been trained to think in fundamentalism. Mm-hmm. Like, we have been, everything is a zero sum game, right? Either I'm right or you're wrong. Like, that's how the world felt for us for a lot of years. And so when you leave the church, or you begin to deconstruct your faith, or you do whatever, you know, you want to do, I think part of the work has to be getting down to undoing that root, that fundamentalism root, because if not, I think what we see a lot, and especially progressive Christian circles, is like that same idea of like, do you have the right words or not?
Mm.
Or else you can't be like, right. It's the work is still attached to this like idea, this fundamentalism concept. And so we got to break that thing all the way down.
Yeah, no, it's so good. The ego or false self sliding towards the spectrum of progression is like, hey, your view's probably better for the world, but you can still do it with the same oppositional, antagonistic, against, you know, fundamentalist kind of spirit that you can on the right, you know?
So. Yeah. Yeah, like, have you ever been, this happens to me sometimes, like, you've been listening to someone and you, like, agree with everything they say, but, like, they're saying it and you're like,
oh my,
why do I not like Why do I not like
you? Y'all, no offense, but why do I not like you?
Yeah, I'm like, why am I hearing it? What's happening? Mm. Right? And it's, there's so many layers, right? We are not a monolith. So like any information that is coming in, it's like, okay, you feel agree, you're yelling at me. It reminds me of like a screamy pastor. That's actually probably my issue, not yours. Okay, let me get, try to listen again. Okay, no, actually, no, I don't. You know what I mean? We have to, the self-awareness has to be on 10, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there, like I would tell people the truth of a spiritual statement, let's say we're talking about like depth of the experience of an individual, not so much social and political stuff. I'm like, but the truth of a spiritual statement is not just in the objective content, what a person's saying, it's in the subjective state of the speaker. So
yeah.
when I have that energy, it's so funny you say that because there's always a few people I can think of where I have that. I'm like, it's not that I disagree with what you said, but there's something about that that leaves me slightly unsettled. And because what I'm sensing in an energetic in your very person is you have not directly realized and become the very thing that you're saying. So somebody can say, oh, about like oneness and unity and everything and letting go. I'm like, I agree with you. It is about letting go, but your neurotic sensibilities are putting on display to me that you don't actually know how to let go. So there's that inner conflict of what a person's saying and where they're at. That's for me, a lot of the thing there.
And then so many words where like that have weird or like that have, like if someone says like, oh, pro-life and you're like, okay, conceptually it's just two words put together. Absolutely. I love life. Like, you know what I mean? But then we have this context of like, oh, what you're meaning is like, do you ascribe to this conservative ideology that believes this and this and this about women and their, you know what I mean? So it's like, even the words aren't just words right now anymore. Yeah. Like they have a whole, you know, host of things. Like if someone says like, oh, it's a Bible believing church, I'm like, oh, they're racist, like, yeah, you know what I mean, like words. It's just like, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm like oh, okay, great, like we're learning more than one language here.
No, I'm with you on that. Well, we jumped, that was so good. We jumped ahead.
Yeah.
That was me, because when you said something, I was just like, all right, I'm jumping way ahead. But even to provide context, I think to so much of the good things you're saying, let's like, if we zoom out a little bit, what are some of the big, and I don't think I know this personally either, what are some of the bigger picture movements in your life, specifically when it comes to your relationship with the church, that help make sense of where you are today? Like, where did you grow up? I'm like in the church and I'm going to Bible college. I go to whatever. Like, what are some of those bigger picture kind of movements?
Yeah. Well, I definitely grew up, so I'm the youngest of three. And so shout out to the babies, the favorites.
Favorites and the neglected, like just they're fine.
Yeah.
Just leave
yeah
them,
like
they're fine.
I'm pretty sure I dropped myself off at college somehow. But so by the time I was born, my parents were like already like in it. Like, you know, they were, so I like literally was born into, okay, we're doing this. We are like bought into the evangelical movement.
Was that in California or no?
So that was in California. Yeah. So I was born in California. I lived there till I was 10, very much in the church.
If you don't mind me asking, where in California?
Yeah, so I was born in Long Beach, shout out. Gotcha. And then lived in Whittier.
Gotcha.
For a while, yeah.
You know, I was born in Temple City.
Oh, really?
We would play, and my wife's from Alhambra.
Oh, no way.
And so, yeah, is Whittier still the San Gabriel Valley or no?
I know, I think,
or
so.
It might be the beginning of LA County or outside of city. I forget, but we would play Whittier in sports growing up. Like, that was close
enough. Really?
Where we would play in Alhambra. So, yeah. I'm probably one of the few people who knows Whittier when you say it. You're
where
probably
that
one
is.
Of the few people who knows Temple City. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm like, oh, no. So, both my parents didn't grow. My mom grew up Catholic, and my dad grew up like loosely Southern Christian, you know, how those people in the South like go to church. It's just a culture. Yeah. But they weren't like in it. So, they went with evangelicalism. So when I was 10, my dad, who was previously in aerospace engineering, felt a call from the Lord.
Wow.
And we all moved to Colorado. And he became the vice president of a little thing called Promise Keepers. Don't know if you remember that one.
Well, here's the thing. When I said earlier, like, I didn't not growing up in the church, these are the things as I'm reading, when I, like, am in my 20s and starting to, like, you know, after I become in the church, I, like, learn about and get what they are, but I never, like, had any personal ties. But I do know what it is.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a big deal in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so that was the beginning of me being, like, a PK, you know? So that was the beginning of, like, our whole life is ministry now. So dad works in ministry. Mom does prayer groups, mentorship. We are, like, so in it. But one thing that my parents did, which I love, so my mom's Mexican, American, my father's African American. And moving to Colorado, they did want us to not, to have as much diversity as we could, being in that town. And so that meant public schools, which I really appreciate, because I feel like if I had a saving grace in this journey, it was like going to public school. So that was delightful. But then, yeah, so when I graduated from high school, I took a year off to, like, listen to God. And decided after that year to go to a Christian college in California.
Which do you mind saying which one that is, or do you like?
Yeah, I try to keep it under wraps for just the sake of my pride. No, I'm just kidding. It was called Azusa Pacific University.
Well, I thought maybe, like, sometimes people are like, oh, you know, like when you're writing and you tell stories, you're like, I want to tell a story, but, like, they don't know. I don't want to, like, put them on blast, you know, like that.
It was called Azusa Pacific University, APU. Gotcha. It's fine. It was, I mean, I have lifelong friends from there, but they are not in any way moving towards the movement of progression. And so I went there for grad school, and then I left and worked at a different Christian college, Pepperdine University in Malibu.
Step up in view and area.
It was,
right
you know, the Azusa Mountains or the Malibu Ocean. And then I left from there to be a pastor at this up and coming mega church near Pasadena. So that is the journey. So,
Interesting.
So I've been in it. In it for a long time.
So the Promise Keepers evangelical world, you're as close to the center as you can possibly be in many ways, you know, in terms of the culture, the church, you know, we're rocking out, you know, like, especially because I think you're 35, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm 36. So it's like, I think about similar stages of, like, life and where we were at the time. And I feel like at that point, and I kind of came just after this, because I first started going to church when I was like 20. But I feel like late 90s, like into 2000, was like mega churches are like, we are taking off and we're never coming. Like, this is it. Like,
I feel like we are the exact age. I was almost the exact age to be present for not only these churches taking off, but in the 90s in the evangelical world was the time where they started making a direct split from the quote secular world in terms of, like, you could live your whole life in the Christian. So Christian school, Christian bookstore, there were Christian bowling alleys, Christian movie theaters, Christian clothing lines.
I've never heard of that.
Oh, what? You haven't lived. Like, I was just talking to my friend the other day. He used to be a worship pastor too. And I was like, oh, did you play sports? Like, we were just, like, driving past the baseball field range, I don't know, whatever, I don't do sports, but and he was like, oh yeah, but I was only in a Christian little league. And I'm like, why did we have Christian little league? Like, we had Christian substitute for everything.
That's insane.
And it was like, yeah, I remember being like, oh, that, why do we have this? But that was the time I grew up in, was like, we are making a split from the rest of the world.
Right. Yeah, that's strong antagonism towards culture, very separative, you know, very, there's this and then there's the world, but there's a clear line between all those things, Well, that's absolutely. Even hearing, I mean, I've heard, I know, again, like I have a, I'm aware of a lot of that as an outsider growing up. And like, I actually just got off the phone with a friend before we talked, who very much grew up in that, where he's like, man, I went to a Christian school where when we would ask questions in class, we would raise a Christian flag.
Yeah.
And just like as a person, like when you think kind of culturally and anthropologically, who's just fascinated with people and cultures and differences, mm-hmm. I'm just as fascinated with that or his experience and yours as he is with mine. Was more like young, like drugs, like we're out of control yeah. when we're young. And to my yeah. world's so foreign to him, but to me it's normal. But that world of like, I would raise a Christian flag, or we would do sword drills with our Bibles. Like, who can come up with the quickest Bible verse? I'm like, I didn't know those yes. types of things. I didn't know youth groups existed. I never heard of those until I was like, in my 20s. Yeah. I was like, oh, I didn't even know kids went to these growing up.
Yeah, they know? Went. They went, and they, you know, there's and that's the thing. I feel like anyone who every human being on this planet has been raised by another human being, and therefore it has not been perfect. But I think a lot of people can look back and say, like, all right, were there parts of it where, like I said, from APU, I have some of the best friends, and they will be my friends for the rest of my life. But also, were there some things where I'm like, we literally pledged allegiance to the Christian flag. After we pledged allegiance to the American flag at church as kids. Wow. And I'm like, youth group, was it cool to make friends? Yes. But also, were there some like, oh my God, I can't even unpack the like sexual, like the trauma of like learning about sex from like a 23-year-old guy who's like, if you do it, you'll regret it for the rest of your life. That's all you need to know. And you're like, what? That can't be all I need to know. That can't yeah. be true, you know?
Oh, yeah, a lot of the stories I hear from those things, I'm like, did you ever see, this was probably 2006-ish, there was a documentary called Jesus Camp?
Yes.
Have you seen that?
Yes.
Okay, so you know it's like hardcore Pentecostal like church camps yeah. or whatever. They're like laying hands on George Bush cutouts and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The woman's like speaking in tongues, trying to get the computer to work. And at that point, like we have some weird parallels in our journey, but at that point, I was at Life Pacific College.
Oh, you know what that snap. Is? Yeah.
Yeah, so it was close, you know, to APU. I mean, APU uh-huh. is actually much more like even academically probably like credible than, you know, Life
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's a small four square. Not to diss them, mm-hmm. I had a great experience like you in terms of like, hey, friends, great people, yeah. but yeah, I'm probably going in different places.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing that movie, and this was when that school was like the first time I was really around Christians. Mm-hmm. Like just my first experience around Christians is at Life Pacific Bible. So it was like youth group two. It was like, here's youth.
And that's
group
the real deal 19. Christians right there. Yeah.
I got a crash course in that world for like 2 to 3 mm-hmm. years. That's why I learned about it. But I remember that movie, and I kind of like brought it up in class, cause I'm kind of like, bro, this is like me and my wife are like watching this documentary. You know, what's weird is my wife saw that documentary. And when she saw Ted Haggard, she was like, something's off about that dude. And then the scandal broke like within a year or two or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But I remember saying like, yeah, that movie, like it's kind of a trip. And but kids were like, that's not different from the camps we went to. Yeah. And I was like, oh yeah. yeah, no, I get it.
yeah, no, yeah, me too. Same. It's so wild. It's yeah, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I know I interviewed D.L. Mayfield on here, and she was telling me that she has like a podcast where they talk about, it's all about like old Christian culture type mm-hmm. of stuff. And I'm like, I don't, oh, like, cool. I don't get most of the reference, all the references, you know, because yeah. I didn't know about Christian Little League, so I can't speak into it.
You haven't Little Leagued. You had to have Bible study before. It's like, you have to do Bible study before you practice.
So Colorado, APU, Pepperdine, mm-hmm. into a mega church in the Southern California like area still.
Yep.
Right. Which Southern California, like LA and Orange County, I feel like religiously for Christians, people from a distance think, oh, it's close to the coast. You know, it's very blue. It's probably more progressive and liberal. But actually, California, from my perspective, when I was there, at least in Orange County and LA area, the church culture, especially for evangelicals, was like, this is, to me, I'm like, this just seems like your classic Southern fundamentalism with like a cool California twist.
It's like fundamentalism, but it's like wearing like,
but we know what to
$1,400 wear. Jordans. Yeah, it's like, it's fundamentalism with Gucci, and you're like, oh, and enough fog and like lasers. And you're like, whoa, was that something racist? I can't tell. The lighting is here so beautiful.
Yeah, I was.
I'm so distracted.
Yeah, my wife and I lived in Costa Mesa for 5 years, which is cool. It's a really cool city. Like made our best friends over there. But I was definitely there, just in the church culture as a whole, and even for how we are with kids and we want to raise a family. I was like, yeah, this is going to be a temporary, you know, thing for us while we're in school. And you get surprised by the churches out there. Where I always found it fascinating, where from a distance, I think the mind can make an assumption about when a church is on the cutting edge of like fashion, and you know, there's a bunch of hipsters and people dress cool. You're like, oh, like I can vibe there. They're probably more open. And I'm like, that means nothing. It's almost the opposite. It's almost like the more they're like that, the more you can be sure it's a Bible believing church.
Absolutely. Or whatever. You know who I, after this experience in like hip mega church world, I'm like, you want to know who I trust as progressive is like some old lady. She's in Birkenstocks and just like a long dress. The church building is not cool. The carpet has seen way better days. Mm-hmm. She's got a little rainbow pin and she's just like there. You know what I mean? She does not care about these looks. She does not care about the lights. You can't see anything. It smells weird, but like they will be down for you. And that was the disheartening thing, and is the disheartening thing about the church, specifically in Los Angeles, where like, you know, there are a lot of these mega churches popping up and doing really well, quote unquote, whatever that means, and the amount of queer people and people of color who call them home because they don't know. And that was like the shady thing. The church I worked at, we all knew where we stood. We all knew we weren't going to marry a queer. We all knew you couldn't be queer. We all knew the rules, but we didn't say them out loud because we had those little queer tithe dollars coming in, right? Like, we knew where we knew women weren't going to be senior pastors. Just, we could be preaching pastors, teachers, leaders. We knew that. We didn't say it out loud, right? You know what I mean? Like, and that's what's upsetting, is that you have so many people in this community who think like, this is my home. I'm here, only to find out the hard way. And
absolutely,
you know, it's just upsetting.
I keep trying to, you know, get back to some of the personal narrative stuff, but you keep saying stuff that's really like anticipating some of the later stuff, like questions. I have a couple of things here. So now I have to jump ahead one more time because of what you said. One, it's interesting. I can think about a young man from who was a part of Imagine. My wife and I started a church here like 7 or 8 years ago, and we've been leading. Yeah. And there's a young man who went to APU and came out there. What? I forget if he got outed or, you know, came out. He's a little bit younger than us. He's probably like 26 ish right now and didn't have a great experience. Grew up in Colorado too. How weird is that?
What?
Yeah. Yeah. And, he was out here at UA, at University of Hawaii, like doing whatever for school. And one had a pretty bad experience playing football at APU, you know, just how things kind of happened.
Yeah.
At some point ended up going to a church that will remain nameless, just because I always tell people it's so fun saying that, you know, to pick the people and they just can't get in, you know?
That's
my psychological technique to keep them interested. But it was one of those more well-branded mega churches. And it was the classic, this people are like me, you know, like a young gay kid, you know, finding his way after church and figuring things out, trying to have hope for the church. And it's like, cool, this church, great. But the closer you get to the center, the more and more that unspoken, to me, like don't ask, don't tell policy of like being
100.
LGBTQ. And you start to meet those invisible walls of resistance. And what I think is so irresponsible about that is you have people who are trying to hold on to hope who have been hurt or have fear of being hurt, which is so legitimate through the culture. Mm-hmm. And it's like they don't discover the barriers until they get closer, which means they probably open their heart a little bit more, which means it's even more devastating when they get there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask you after you said that. Like, there's a dangerous form of bait and switch that many churches do. You know, while they say, and I'm sure you've heard this, everyone's welcome as they are. And I believe deep down they mean that in terms of like their ability to actually live it out. Like they want to mean that, you know, I really think so. But what ends up happening, like I said, is they get a little bit closer. They start to connect to community. Maybe they're more involved and they discover that there are barriers towards their full participation as LGBTQ people, as being leading or connecting or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes another traumatic, oh, I'm not actually, the fullness of who I am isn't welcome here. Like being in the church, being a person, a person who's not only on staff, but a person who identifies as queer, a person who got married. Like, you've kind of been through so much of that and have seen so much behind the curtains. Do you see that bait and switch? Is that a thing? You know, is that like, talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's absolutely a thing. And you know, I got into it with just about every person on staff after I left, right? Because I'm not afraid of a little conversation. And one of the things I said and will continue to say is, listen, it's honestly, this is America. So you get, if you believe that queer people are not in the fullness of what God has for them, or the fullness of how you think a person should live, then honestly, it's your right to believe it, but be clear about it. Own it. Because here's what's upsetting, and here's why we have the bait and switch. Because these churches do not want to take on the backlash for owning what they actually believe in an upfront way.
Absolutely.
Because these churches came out, the church, they come out and they say, hey, listen, we just want to be very clear. We are not LGBTQ affirming. We are affirming of women up until this point. Our conversation on race will not include these intersections. Have a nice day. They know that that will not be popular. And this is what I keep saying. I'm like, every single queer person has had to pay the price of standing in their truth. Mm-hmm. All we ask is that you stand in yours. I'm not asking you to change your entire theological position. If this is where you stand, then stand there. But you have to be clear about it. Mm-hmm. You absolutely need to, it is the most kind thing to do. Mm-hmm. Which is my thing that I say all the time. My friend George, he started this thing called Church Clarity, but every conversation I have, I'm like, listen, I am not out to change your mind. Mm. If you believe that queer people are not invited at your table, fine. I am only on a mission to make that clear to them. Right? Because if not, you're like, bro, like, fine, believe it, but you have to pay the cost for being clear about it. Mm. I had to pay mine. Mm. You had to pay yours. That's the way the world works. Yeah. You cannot sit on the fence and try to dupe people in only for them to get close and be rejected.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think, like, when I was at like a larger mega church, you know, 10, 12 years ago in Orange County around that time, I think it seemed like back then it was easier for churches to get away with, let's be as vague as possible for the sake of not really not having to talk about it. And now, because the broader culture is changing at such a rapid pace, that's becoming less and less tenable because of things like Church Clarity, just because of the conversation as a whole, because more and more queer people who are Christians and self-identify as Christians are like being seen, are having platforms in ways they never did before. Like it's putting the social pressure and making it less possible, where it's like, you can't just do the vague sermon of like, we're welcoming in a vague way. Now it's like, you can own it either way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's becoming harder to do the old thing, which is that, which creates unintentionally, I think, for them, that bait and switch culture, which ends up hurting so many people. Like I've experienced from like the kid I mentioned, young kids in my church, friends of mine who are, you know, trying to still somehow stay connected with God and following Jesus in the church, you know, as they're coming to terms with and owning their own sexuality and their own life, you know? So
yeah.
Yeah. I've always felt you can be gay, you can be bi, you can be queer in this community as long as you never talk about it. And even though we all know, it's like a weird conspiracy. And I was 20, I'm like, oh, it's this weird conspiracy of silence where they just don't want to talk about it. And you're trying to like, I just found that to be the weird, I was like, what is?
There's so much weirdness. You know, I had a friend come out when we were, well, he's younger than me. So when he was still in college at APU, and he was in like leadership positions on campus. And one thing they told him, they're like, okay, this is APU being progressive. They had changed their statement on sexuality, which was in our student handbook. And at first it said, you can't be gay. Then they changed it to, all right, you can experience same-sex attraction because that's out of your control, but you can't act on it. So he would be in like meetings and being like, okay, well, yeah, you could be in this role. You just like can't ever date anyone. And you're like, why was that ever okay? And why did we ever think like, oh, okay, like this seems normal. Like, we were in a freaking cult basically that was like, let me watch your every move, tell you who you can and can't date, what you can and can't do, like what are the words you can use. Come sing with us on this day. It was, it's wild, right? And we create all these little codes of conduct, and you think to yourself, at some point I was so far in the church is what kept me in the closet for so long, is I was like, where do I go if I'm not here? All my friends are here, all my networks, all my connections, everything I am as a human feels like it is tied to this place. And so in that, you're willing to like let a lot of like little things go, little things, quote unquote, because you don't want to lose your connection, right?
Yeah, well, that's a good segue. Now that we've done two long rabbit trails, both my fault. Now back to the story. I love a rabbit trail. Yeah. And now, but that's a good, you know, talking about, even when you talk about all these rules, but what's funny is a lot of those rules, it's like a family system where no one ever tells you the rules, but everyone knows them and everyone abides by them. You know what I'm saying? So you do church, APU, now you're at a large church. And then I'm going to read this quote that I found of yours. And then I want you to tell that personal experience being at the church and the journey after that.
Yeah.
You say, feeling something so natural and so good and having it collide with the world you existed in was really, really traumatic. So you are working at a major mega church. You are an up and coming star, you know, in the evangelical world. You know, a promise keeper's kid is going to just keep on taking off, you know.
Evangelical star on the rise.
And so that's happening. But along the way, somehow you start to have feelings for, have a relationship with, and fall in love with a girl named Sammy who would eventually become your wife. So you just said your identity is so tied to a particular culture, place, people. Like, it's like everything. It's all encompassing thing, right? And then you start to have these feelings. You start to have this relationship. What then happens? What is happening with you? What's happening within you? And how do you go from the first realization of romantic feelings, sexual attraction, connection, into what goes on after that? How do you move forward with that?
No, that's a good question, and it took me a long time to figure it out. I met her at church. She was volunteering for the college ministry that I was starting. And up until this point, it wasn't, I don't have one of the stories where, like I knew I was gay when I was very young and sort of kept it in. And partially in relation to my Christianity, like that I was so disconnected from myself, particularly like my own sexuality, that I didn't even, you know, sorry about that. I always joke that it's the best place in the world to be closeted is church, because when I would be like, oh, I'm not tempted at all to have sex with a man, and people would be like, that's good. Like, God is, you know, like, and I'd be like, oh, okay, I guess I'm doing it right then, you know, like I'm not interested in this at all. And they'd be like, good job, you know? So meeting Sammy really opened up a part of myself that I didn't even know was there. You know, and I met her when I was 27. So it's like, you know, I'm older than most people when they figure out who they're attracted to. But in, I mean, I just like, I met her and I was like, I'm so captivated by this. I want her to be my best friend in the world. I want to hang out there every day, you know? And it didn't take long before I was like, oh my God, I get it. I get everything that people have always talked about. Wow. In terms of falling in love and being attracted to someone. And so almost, I mean, that was a journey. It was just hard. Mm. And I remember one of the first things Sammy and I both were like, we need a therapist. Like we have to talk to someone about this. We don't feel safe enough to talk to anyone in our life. Like,
wow.
So
you guys started connecting, forming a relationship. It's just hidden.
Yes.
But you're hanging out, you're connect, you're doing all like,
yes. And everyone in our life was like, oh, they're best friends. Gotcha. And we started going to therapy together and separate. Mm. And, I remember telling my therapist that being like, this feels like the best thing that's ever happened in my life. I always describe it as like, it felt like air for the first time, like falling in love with Sammy. I was like, oh my God, like this is breathing. This is what human connection is supposed to be. And then in the same breath, which, you know, my stomach turns every time I think about this. And I literally told my therapist, I said, but I can't tell if it's just a test.
Mm.
Like, is this God testing me? Because all these amazing things are happening. And I am this, you know, evangelical star on the rise, and I have all these opportunities. Like, is this a test? Am I supposed to turn down something this amazing? And then that will be my keys to the kingdom, basically, wow. Right? Which is like, I can't even,
which,
you know,
talk
now
about,
I look back.
Like, psychological and emotional.
Come on, pressure. Right? And like,
wow,
trauma, like my first response to something really good is like, this is a test to see if I'll give this up for God. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And you know, thank God for my therapist who was like, that sounds like trauma.
Was your therapist a Christian or no?
So, and looking back, I'd say she was where we are now.
Hmm. Hmm.
Which was amazing. So she understood
totally
the language, and she understood, but she was like not having it. She was,
gotcha,
like, no, like you sound, yeah, like someone. She literally would tell me at times, she's like, you sound like someone who has been abused, like in the way you talk about God. And I'm like, what?
You know? you're like, but Christian Little League, how it can't,
yeah,
be.
Awanas, I pledged allegiance to the Christian flag. Yeah. So, I mean, she eventually married us, at our wedding. She played such an important role. I don't know what we would have done truly. I think we would have figured it out, but, she's amazing. And so eventually it got to the point where Sammy had, I think, less holding her back than me.
Mm.
Only because she kind of like you, but maybe a little bit earlier, like she was like 16-ish when she sort of got into the church, and her family was kind of like loosely tied. Mm. Like, you know what I mean? Like it wasn't, yeah,
drastically different experience than yours.
Yeah. A lot of her community growing up was like from sports or these different things. And so she was like, we'll just go and build a new community. And I just would tell myself, like, I kept thinking, like, what do I can't work at APU. I would be cutting off every community and network I've had. And that's so scary. And so we were closeted for 3 years.
Wow.
And over those 3 years, we slowly started telling more of our, like, I told my parents, my sister, brother, close friends. Like, we had slowly kind of created this circle. But it all came down to me just being able to sort of cut those ties and knowing that I was cutting those ties. Like, I know this, you know, this is what's going to happen. And so, I mean, looking back now, I'm like, Jesus, I should have done that, you know, day one, but I had to work that out, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so it was a journey for sure.
So did you eventually have to have like a conversation with the lead pastor where you're like, this is where I'm at, I'm choosing to leave, or this is where I'm at, you make a decision? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no. So I arrived at the point where I was like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be with Sammy That is the life I'm choosing. That is what I want. And I know that that means leaving my job. And I hadn't figured out yet. I don't know. And when or what. And so 2 days after, I sort of had this like realization moment in my mirror, in my apartment. Like I had this like beautiful moment with God. And I was like, yes, you, this is what you do. And 2 days later, we were just in a meeting, in a random meeting. And it, the issue came up that there was a lesbian couple who wanted to lead a small group. And they're like, so who should call them and tell them they can't? And you ever have those moments where you just like see a color? Like everything just went red and I lost it. And I just start like, I just am like going in. And like halfway through, I was like, this is for sure me quitting my job. Didn't think that was going to happen today.
You're, like, you're cool. You're cool. You're cool.
Yeah. I'll mess with you. Never you. You'll never see my paycheck. And I'm like, I'm like, I can't believe these people are like, you're going to take their money, but you won't let them. Like, this is such an embarrassment to like, who, you know? And then I was like, at the end of that, I was like, okay.
And so what, did you just walked out of the room?
Yeah, so then everyone left the room. They're like, we're going to go get lunch. I was like, yeah. And then the senior pastor came in. I was like, hey, I think we need to talk. He's like, yeah, I think we do.
Yeah, no, I think we need to talk.
Yeah, yeah, no, I called this meeting. Yeah, I'm in charge. And that was me leaving, and
But when you went, when you saw red and you said, like, did you say like, I'm in a relationship?
No, I didn't. And specifically, and when I left too, cause I was like, I don't know. I just kind of felt like you don't deserve this information from me. Like, you'll find out how you find out, but I'm going to tell you right now, I am leaving because of this church's treatment of queer people.
Gotcha.
That's why I'm leaving. Mm. And then like a month later we came out publicly. Like, what? I was like, I told you. It was because of your treatment of queer people. I am one of them.
Yeah, you just didn't know I was talking about me.
Me, yeah. You know, I was just talking about some obscure, but I don't know. Yeah, so, and ever since then, I mean, things have, you know, it was hard and we had a lot of hard conversations and lost friends and relationships and gained friends and relationships. Yeah. But I would do it a trillion times over to have a life I have now.
Yeah, yeah. That, I tell people all the time, like, one, in ways that would be a great irony for a lot of Christians in conventional spaces to hear this or to even think about it. But I'm always like, you don't understand the amount of grace it takes for a queer person to have any desire to be a part of a church. In a community and a movement that is centered around this idea of grace and this gift of this is for everybody. It's all accessible right now. I'm like, and the value of that theoretically, I'm like, but the people that you want to marginalize are the very people that are having to embody, live it out, breathe it, and extend it to you silently in ways you would never even imagine. Just for them to even try to remain a part of this is like one of those great tragic ironies. And also like, you know, one of a common thing I see now, you know, is a lot of pastors who are a little bit older than me, probably like early 40s, and they start doing vocational ministry in their 20s, and maybe they finally plant a church or they come on staff somewhere, and they have this like, it's almost like you go through a journey of how can I push this as far as I can and be as progressive as possible, but still be tied to like the center of the evangelical thing and still be an insider. And eventually I think their life doesn't allow them to do that if they're honest. And they go through a journey where it's like, am I going to be fully honest in regards to my following of Jesus, my pursuit of truth, and me allowing what feels like the Spirit of God calling me forward into an expanding and evolving faith? And if I say yes to that, I'm eventually probably going to have to say no to a lot of what I've built my entire life around, my relationships, networks, friendships, or whatever it is. And then there's a long journey of coming to terms with if you're going to do that, are you going to lose your life to actually find it? Just like the Jesus we say we're following, you know?
Absolutely.
And that is a journey where for a lot of cisgender, straight, white male pastors, like, of course they're going to go through hard things, but they're doing that without the added on weight and heaviness of being a person who identifies as a part of a historically marginalized and oppressed group, which adds obviously dimensions of weight. Unless you're in it, you can never understand. So I think that journey is such a like archetypal journey for everybody. It's just, to me, for you to choose honesty, for you to choose authenticity is even harder and takes even more to do that. You know, in some ways for other folks, it wouldn't, because the cost will likely be even greater in light of the history and the kind of relationships you had. So it's a great, you know, it's a model and it's an amazing witness, of course, for people of faith who are queer and go through that, but it's honestly just for everybody trying to choose authenticity when they know there's going to be a big cost, which for me, like, that's the actual, if you want to go into the real next journey of following Jesus, especially into the second half of your life and towards authenticity outside of structures and appeasing them, I'm like, there's going to come a defining moment where that has to happen. You know, and that I love those stories, because I'm like, those are the stories we see in movies that makes our heart leap. But those are the moments when it comes our time to do it where our heart shuts. You're like, oh, because it's just so real. You know what I mean?
It is. It's, you know, there's so many things. And I idolize a lot of the leaders from the civil rights movement. And what a lot of them showed me was something bigger than you, something that you might not even get to live into. The beauty of giving up this church for Loving Sammy is that now I get to have this beautiful life with this woman, right? But there are times though where we have to choose authenticity, and we might not even immediately get that payoff. Like, you can make the sacrifice and not even see it. Like, a lot of folks gave everything to a movement that they didn't get to see the end of. And, you know, one of the things, I know we're almost out of time here, but one of the things I'll say this, I firmly believe and always say it is queer people who will lead the revolution of the church, right? Because it is queer people who understand and embody exactly what you're saying. It is the story of Christ. It is this, okay, well, you can't have Sunday without Friday. And everyone wants to live into the Sunday reality. Well, then you need to talk to some people who have been through Friday. The people who have said, no, what I will do is put everything on the line to be true to who I am, what I believe in, what I believe to be true about the world. Those are the people we need in our churches, leading, contributing, showing up, shaping, because those are the people who understand fundamentally who I am is good and valuable and true and worth something. That is the exact message that Jesus came to say. Who you think is powerless is actually the most powerful. Mm. Who you think does not have value has the most. And so as we kick these queer kids out of our churches, we need to stop and realize that is, if the church is, I mean, dying, it is going down in flames. You don't need a theological degree to know that. And if you want to have a chance of revival, I think we need to start rounding up all of these queer people and begging them to be a part of shaping what happens next, because I think they're the leaders we need.
And with this great theme of this podcast of you anticipating every question I was going to ask, that I don't even need to ask it anymore since we're wrapping up, where I was going to end with, you know, where do you see the liberating Jesus in the Gospels? You know, what stories, words, and moments of his life and experience really stay with you in your journey? But you kind of jumped ahead, and I think that's an amazing response to that. And, you know, just for me as a person who in our church ends up in the lives of, you know, a lot of younger queer people, you know, finding their way. You know, like, Imagine becomes a place for them to breathe for the first time, which I value so highly, and a place where kids come out for the first time in church, which is amazing, you know, and those types of experiences. You have an amazing story. And I think to me, I'm like, authenticity, the question that's always guided me in life is just what's real. That's all I've ever asked, you know, and this is where I'm at as a result of it. And, you know, who knows where I'll be in 10 years and 20 years, because that's kind of my journey. So I think the choosing of authenticity at the cost, the desire to allow the spirit to form us into what is real and who we are, no matter what happens, I'm like, that's the thing. That's what opens the path to a future that not only allows us to do the work, but to also enjoy, because we're doing it out of who we are. And that's just such a marker of your journey. And it's such a, like I said, is it a model? Are you the pioneer ahead for so many young queer people who are going to go on their own unique versions of that? Absolutely. But it's really just a journey for everybody who's wanting to choose that level of freedom and authenticity. So with that said, the book Worth It, if you want to get this is a glimpse into the more detailed, thorough telling of the story and some of Britt's even, you know, more developed thoughts around this that always comes through writing, Worth It, please go buy that book. Follow her on Instagram and other places she's at. Is it just Britt Baron?
Just Britt Baron.
Britt Baron. Follow her journey. It really is such a unique journey that I hope more and more people will be aware of and pay attention to, which so many people already are. And this was so good. I'm so grateful that you took the time to come on. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. And follow along her journey and you'll get more of the goodness that you experience here. So thanks, Britt.
Thanks so much.